What's up? Welcome to Sweathead with Mark Pollard. I have Caitlin Maud from Austin, co-founder of Current Forward. What's up, Caitlin?
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Pleasure. Austin's one of those places that I think about a lot as I get into and then try to survive a New York winter. Tell me about the weather today.
A little overcast, but welcomed. We just had 2 weekends of ACL and about 100 degree weather, so I'm enjoying this little break from the heat.
Oh, it's finally fall here.
Finally fall, 75 degrees.
Okay. In the middle of a New York winter, I'm just going to play back your weather report and I'm going to be happy.
Come back. Come hang with us. Everyone's invited.
So we're going to chat creating products out of strategy services, which is one of those funny sentences that you hear in agencies every now and then. And we're going to take it seriously, but not too seriously.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it for people, maybe in agencies, people who are freelancing, people who are independent, to push them to think about ways to turn themselves into products, but also to question whether that's a thing that you even need to do. What are some strategy products that you've come across, or even products just that have something to do with consulting and services, which may or may not have anything to do with the work that we do, but what are some ways that people have turned their time and services into products that are interesting to you?
Yeah, so I love the discussion you kicked off in Sweathead about this, because there were a lot of people chiming in with books. And I think books are like the lowest hanging fruit version of this. And there are many lists, probably Sweathead episodes about great strategy books. But when I think about productizing strategy services, I start to think a little bit beyond books in things that are more experiential or more tangible. So like the next level of above books would be something like education. So the oldest one sort of running would be like Miami Ad School's Planner Bootcamp, which I think has been rebranded at this point. But more recently, IDEO has their IDEOU and design thinking certification, which is an interesting way of kind of packing up learning strategy and growing as a strategist. Beyond that, there are some tools that I definitely think about and use a lot. So there's a consultancy called Nobel that was started by a former digital strategist, Bud Cadell. And they have a whole group of tools for folks that are doing more the consulting or organizational side of strategy. So there's this one tool that they put out that's excellent called the Decider app. And you install it in Slack and it pulls in a lot of different decision-making frameworks. So teams can collaborate on how to come to an important decision together. I think there's also kind of adjacent to education, different methods of doing strategy that have been packaged up or productized to make them either easier to execute on or sell or license. And the one that immediately comes to mind is the Google Ventures Design Sprint, which was documented in the book Sprint, and is like a 5-day workshop sprint methodology to pressure test startup ideas. Pretty cool, a way of like productizing just an internal process that they had. Mm-hmm. The last one that I wanted to mention that I just think is cool, which is something we all already use, and it was packaged up and productized as kind of a new use case. Bonnie Wan, who's the head of strategy at GoodBe, created something called the Life Brief, which is a little workbook creative brief, but more centered around personal development. Mm-hmm. So you can just Google Bonnie Wan, W-A-N, Life Brief, and find that and buy that. And it's like a actual tangible workbook that you get in the mail and you can go through it and it asks you questions to rethink how you might brief the next phase in your life, for example.
Got it. So I'm just going to read some of these back out. We've got...
Yeah, what else we got?
We've got books. We've got education, which could be online or offline. Workshops. Yeah. On-demand research is an interesting thing that's popping up more and more and more. Kind of software or app or tool, deliverables. Like every now and then I hear people talk about licensing, you know, like licensing a set of templates. I don't know how common it is and I don't know how easy it is to enforce. You'd have to have a very good trusting relationship with a client. Then there's the methodology and then even events, which we didn't talk about. I mean, here's the thing that I've often struggled with is when we use the word product or even productize, what are we actually saying? Because a book is a physical product. I think that's easy for people to wrap their heads around. Is that the same kind of product as, hey, we're going to do a 2-day workshop and it's $10,000? Are they the same or are we using the language differently?
think they're the same. I think I'm using the language a little bit differently. So when we think, my partners and I think about productizing our offering, there are a few reasons that we do that, just to give you all a peek behind the curtain. The first is really about philosophically just making strategy work more accessible to folks. So for example, small business owners who may not otherwise be able to pay for strategy services, when we're able to package up our knowledge and experience to help people like entrepreneurs kind of do it themselves as a preferable option to doing no strategy work, it ends up being a win-win because then we don't have to turn down the work, but they still feel like they're able to get the benefits of working with us. So a good example of something like that would be like a consulting or a coaching package that's pretty low barrier to entry, like workbooks, kind of like we talked about with the example of Bonnie Wan. My partners and I have put out a workbook that tackles like one particular part of the strategy process around unconscious bias. The other two reasons are actually a lot more practical why productizing something like strategy could be helpful, which is having a proprietary approach to something that's quite common just helps a company differentiate from others. So the Google Design Sprint is exactly what you were talking about, Mark, where it's like, it's sort of a ubiquitous methodology at this point. Like, it's really hard for them to enforce a license to be like a Google Ventures Design Sprint facilitator when so many agencies have their own version of that, their own version of like that workshop methodology. But I do think being able to brand your approach to something gives people a little bit more of a unique taste of how you might help them problem solve. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing is really, if you can productize something, it does help you sort of align on a standard approach to common activities. So it can really create efficiencies internally. Like, not every strategy project is going to be the same, but if there are standard inputs that you can learn about yourself or your team that really help you do your best work that are repeatable, capturing those in some sort of like a template form won't only help you, but it could help the folks that work with you, whether those are your clients or your teammates, so you're not reinventing the wheel every project.
Yeah. I think in general, there are so many companies who could buy strategy, but they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. They're not sure how to do it. They don't know whether to trust the people they're buying from. And then if they get it, they don't know necessarily how to implement it. And so it can lead to this weird standoff. And that standoff for the work we do competes with people who in culture are more definitively known as strategists because they have letters like MBA after their titles. And so there can be this weird kind of wrangling going on. But I think the principles that I relate most to in what you're talking about there as far as why to do any of this and what language you actually use is, first of all, to stand up for your value, so that you're not selling time, and that you're protecting your value and trying to make a value-based pricing decision. The second is make it easy to buy. If you're decently known and easy to buy, from what I understand, you'll probably do better than you're doing right now. And then there's the differentiation. So even if you launch a product that people don't use that much, if it's part of a catalog of products or it's consistent with how you like how you put yourself out into the world, launching it might actually send an interesting brand signal. And it's kind of part of your marketing. And then the final one, I think, as far as people who are independently oriented in the work that they do, is the question, how can I be more effective without getting sucked into politics and mess and emails? And so that's really about signal versus noise. So there's some of the themes that I totally relate to with what you just went through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you really nailed it with kind of reiterating something that we have talked a lot about internally, because there are risks associated with productizing, but we are sort of internal barometer of when it's appropriate to productize is when it makes something more accessible, but not necessarily more simple. We're not trying to simplify the strategy process because it's inherently complex, it's inherently subjective. But what we're trying to do is make a way of thinking, a way of doing things slightly more accessible to folks that need the work and can benefit from the work, or people who are earlier on in their career It is sort of like a philosophical thing as well, that it can make, like you said, it can make these approaches and ways of working a little bit more palatable for people when there's a product that they can buy that at least just gets them in the door and helps meet their needs.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I saw this especially when I was younger, the process or the product and some kind of methodology behind it can help someone sell it internally to someone more senior who's trying to justify the cost. It's kind of funny, like when I joined Leo Burnett briefly in New York, they had a small office here, and I was led to believe that we were going to be able to create some kind of new agency model and put a little white paper out on the internet with YouTube, with a video as well. It's all on YouTube. If you look up X10, there's probably other words around it, but X, the letter X and then 10, you'll be able to find this thinking from several years ago. It didn't last more than a month or two because apparently that's not what the agency was interested in. I don't know why I was able to believe that that's what we were going to do. But honestly, it was like, okay.
Test and learn.
Yeah, there you go. You know, a lot of it was built around sprints and things that are kind of obvious if you've grown up doing digital work for 10 years. And then you're like, why don't we do this in advertising more often in a bigger way? And then you're like, oh, the model of retainer and sloppiness and mess and having lots of people, that's how you make money. And so that's a huge risk, that if you create products, you might hurt yourself financially.
Absolutely.
How do you navigate those kinds of conversations and debates?
So here's the thing. This is the one risk that I made sure to underline in my notes that I wanted to talk about. It's like, productization not only puts your relationships at risk, but it can make shittier work. So ultimately, if you are trying to distill something down, you might be cutting corners in research, for example, which could put the success of the project, or worse, the experience of the end customer or user at risk. And to your point, it can definitely undermine the value of the craft of what you're doing. If it becomes thought, whether amongst your current clients who you've maybe had a retainer relationship with, or amongst new business prospects, that you can just like pop into a URL and out comes a strategy, that clients and teams will fail to see the value of like having us on staff or having us on retainer. And so it is definitely something that's tricky to navigate, and why we just try to be really intentional about it and kind of think about specific use cases. So small businesses for us was a place that we're just not going to say yes to those projects anyway. There's a high threshold of bespoke services that, high threshold in terms of fee for bespoke strategy services with us that kind of lead to an engagement. There's 4 people on our team that need to get paid. And if we're going to be engaging a full team in a project, it has to be worthy of that effort. So for us, it makes more sense to have a product that we can offer businesses that aren't ready to do, or even frankly need to do, a full deep strategy engagement with us, because we can actually just offer them a product. But the other thing that comes to mind when you're talking about agencies, and I don't know the best way to put it, it's almost like they're sort of like human centipeding themselves. if they're putting out all these products like sprints and things like that, or workshops that are devaluing the retainer relationship, I would argue or challenge that potentially we're just seeing the AOR model starting to fade anyway. It's so much work is moving to project-based work as it is. So if you can start to align with that habit, or have services and products, as we're talking about, that meet the needs of a changing client base that want to engage different agencies for different parts of projects, for different parts of their business, then you might actually be ahead of the curve, or just accommodating a need that's already out there. If you're relying too much in a retainer relationship, you're going to be in a tough situation anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that focus on products could lead to conversations that focus on the number of products sold. Like, we need to sell 20 of these things versus the number of like positive relationships. I think that's like a dynamic that could come into play that further commoditizes the thing that we're all trying to defend and fight for. The other thing is using products as a way to fight off the pitch process, so that you might say, well, we're not going to pitch And if you're a certain size of agency, that is a very difficult thing to think and let alone say out loud. But we're not going to pitch. We're going to do a workshop for X thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Have you seen that technique used much?
Yeah, agencies do it. I just was at a networking event on Monday or Tuesday and was talking with Crystal, one of the co-founders of Preacher here in Austin. And she said, you know, once we decided not to pitch, it was one of the best decisions we ever made in their business. And she was kind of giving me advice as an early founder, and it's worked out really well for them. They've leaned into their areas of expertise, and they've built up enough of the relationship side of their business, to your point, that their incoming pipeline is mostly referral based, and they continue to do great work that gets attention. So I think there is definitely a situation where that can work, but they may be the exception and not the rule. So for us, being smaller, being lesser known, and not having a tangible, beautiful design output like Preacher has for us to get a lot of attention through, we just have our brains. We only do strategy. I think one of the things that we have seen is that sometimes the products can actually work as new business for us. So when we did something like our unconscious bias training and then turned that into a workbook, we've actually had a number of people come to us for our point of view on diversity and inclusion in the strategy process, which is something we never set out to be subject matter experts in, but it turns out there's actually a strong business need for that. And companies are really being held to a different standard when it comes to, you know, combating unconscious bias in their process. And so it's actually created a new pipeline of work for us and new services and relationships that we wouldn't have even had had we been out pitching, or had we been out just focusing on doing some of our paying client service-based work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and what's funny about all of this is it depends on your self-awareness, what you're in it for, and then how you think people usually buy what we do. Usually they, like, unless they're robotic and very distant procurement-oriented companies, people want to do business with people in this industry. And you can point to surveys that show that. You can point to procurement panels that talk about that. You could go to an agency's website statistics and see how the people page is usually from the, I don't know, multiple agency websites I've been involved with, is usually one of the top two or three pages that people look at. And part of that could be people looking for jobs. But,
yeah,
you know, so you start to thread these thoughts together, which could be the people that you want to work with, work with people that they like. They usually come through referral versus cold call. There's usually some kind of meeting. You get on, you test each other, you enjoy each other, you do some sort of simple work together, and it becomes a flourishing relationship. It's like that series of, I guess, sentences there or thoughts there, that logic, it's difficult to honor that, I think. Do you find that? Like, you
100%
continually remind yourself what you're about and how this thing works?
100%. We were fortunate enough to be a woman-owned business, and we got an opportunity with a major alcohol conglomerate to come in through their women and minority owned business procurement specialist and get the opportunity to talk a little bit about the business. And holy moly, was I excited. I was preparing. I was like, okay, gonna crush this, like gonna get a huge, like $1 billion client. Like, I just was over the moon to have the opportunity to talk to someone in procurement. And it was fine. Like, it was just one of those calls you get off and you're like, did that go good? Like, was that a good conversation? Did they like me? Like, did they even understand what I was saying? And what we do is a really important, but kind of heady and tricky part of the process. So talking to someone about insights and the value of insights, for example, whose role is to do procurement, which is essentially identifying and negotiating with vendors on behalf of a company, it just doesn't get them excited. It's hard to really rally them around your differentiation, you know, your approach, maybe, or proprietary way of doing things. And so we just got off the call and it felt like it had really sucked the energy out of the room. And so what we try to do, to your point, is like, yes, referrals, yes, do great work, yes, have relationships, but also take frequent moments to look back at what has worked in the past. So who were the clients that you closed? Who were the clients that you loved working with? How did they find you? And start to look for patterns in what has worked, because it's still important and great to take new opportunities, I think, and risks when you can and try new ways of getting business. But at the end of the day, when I look back at what has worked, it's always been through referrals. It's always been through putting our point of view out there and content out there. It has been through events that we host and content, products that we've put out there, but also just like relationships, bigger agencies that don't have the ability to take on a piece of business or want to bring us in to support a piece of their business. It's never for us come through a pitch or procurement, but that if that is the way that business is coming in for you, then continue to do that, because there are a lot of folks that aren't.
Yeah. Because the thing is, like, once you write these assumptions / principles / truths down, it's liberating, but also kind of scary to honor them.
Yeah, because, of course.
It might mean that you don't need much of a website. It might mean that you don't talk at a bunch of conferences, especially those kind of industrial complex conferences where people are like, can you come and talk at this thing with 100 other people? We're not going to pay you. And I don't know, just you pay for yourself to get here and it's going to be great. Like, I don't know if people really build business out of that sort of stuff. Not the kind of business that we do that requires nuance and some kind of head connection.
Yeah.
But like, it's scary and fun. Like, what's the most surprising thing you've come across, assumption or principle or truth, about the types of people and companies that you work with that you didn't know a year ago? That's a long question. What have you learned? What have you learned about how people want to hire you and work with you? And what's like the most awkward truth to honor about what you think you've learned?
Oh man.
Yeah.
I don't want to kill dreams, but I might kill a few dreams with this one. So the choice, the intentional, very hard choice not to work with small businesses for us was a really, really hard one to land on, because being a small business, of course I want to work with small businesses. They might be the next one that blows up, or, you know, they have a lot of passion for what they do. I really identify with small businesses and small business owners and want to be a part of that ecosystem. But the actual dream-killing truth associated with this for us in our experience has been, and this was true for when I would try to do this work independently as well, is that there is a certain level of maturity that a business needs to be at to really benefit from particularly brand level strategy work. So many of the small businesses we talk to, we have had to say no to because they are seeing brand strategy work as highly associated with a need to make money. Frankly, what they need are things like a marketing plan, a advertising budget, a media plan, a person on staff to do marketing. Brand strategy work is for businesses that have achieved a certain level of validation in their product or their business model. Brand strategy cannot be your business model. Unfortunately, brand is something that exists in the mind of the consumer. It's not something that builds a business in the same way. You still need a business plan. You still need a marketing plan. You still need to advertise. And so for so many companies who will even just say $10,000, I think it was the number you threw out earlier, $10,000 for an emerging brand is what we like to call them, is a big amount of money to invest in something. Mm-hmm. And there are many times where that investment would be better spent on social ads than working with us, because we need inputs to know what would be the most effective strategy for them. Without those inputs, we are doing our best guesses, which is a lot of what strategy work is in general. But if they can spend a year investing in some tests on social, in some tests in advertising and other channels, in doing a little bit of their own research, we will be in such a better place if their product is proving to continue to grow in sales the next year.
I agree. I think I've done a little bit of stuff with small business. I love it too. I really identify with it. It's difficult because sometimes the way that I get approached is that someone will say, I need help with branding. And I'm like, okay, let's talk about that word and what you actually need. Where it really comes to life for me is in more of a therapeutic model where you're trying to work out what's in that person that they want to put into the world and build a business around. That's exciting to me because that's about, like, it's more of a psychological journey than a brand journey. The trouble with that, there's two troubles. One is that the words you give them back, they're like, they might wonder, like, is this a brochure? What do I do with this? Is this like words that I copy and paste and put on a banner ad or something? I don't quite know what to do with it. So you kind of have to help them through that next phase. And then the second one is that without customers or without adequate customers, as you're saying, you know, I think it's totally fine just to make something up and have a stance, but you still need to be able to tweak and mold it to the business as it grows and attracts people, like people who are giving you money for it. So I think there are a couple of the riddles I see in that space.
Yeah, absolutely. And so every person, if you're setting out on a journey to be a freelancer or consultant, or you're starting your own small strategy shop, or you're even internal at a company, maybe supporting new business efforts, it's a matter of figuring out what inputs you need to be successful. And for me to be successful for my clients, I learned over the course of my career that it requires some measure of success, at least with a product. They don't have to have a brand yet. I can help them get there or think about that, but they need to be achieving a certain amount of sales and success to have proven out the model of their business for me to help them do strategy work that I'm proud of.
Okay. Then getting back into the product topic itself, are there any other risks that you think that we haven't discussed yet that people might run into as they think about productizing? It's a beautiful word, but productizing what they do.
I think the thing that comes to mind is just more of an example than like an additional risk or a challenge, but we can look at something like smartphone cameras. So how ubiquitous it is that everyone now has a camera in their pocket and everyone can be a photographer, but as we have gotten more access to photography, I do believe that we're able to see, understand, and attest to the value of professional photography even more. I think we see there is still a difference between something that a professional photographer can do on your wedding or in landscape photography, that there's still an art, even though everyone has access to try to do some of those things themselves. Mm-hmm. So I try, when we talk about risks and fears associated with commoditization of strategy, for example, I would say that the well is very, very deep. We can each have a little taste of doing strategy ourselves. We can educate our clients on how to do some of their own customer research, and it still will not undermine the work that we do, just purely given our collective experience in the space and the number of ways that we know to approach problems.
Yep. What do you think about this? Do you think it's okay to launch a product? Do you need to launch a suite of products to allow certain choices to happen and for there to be a broader context that not just communicates what you're about as a strategy person or a strategy company, but to help people make better decisions and so that you have things to potentially upsell people to? Do you need a suite or a catalog of products?
That's a really good question. No, because I think it's important to test and learn. This is what we would tell clients, right? Is we would tell them if they're going to put a new product to market or they're going to try communicating in a new channel or with new content, we would run a test with them and we would see how it goes. I think there is absolutely no risk to putting out just one product and seeing how it performs and then using that to inform whether or not it's a good use of your effort to come out with a suite of products.
Okay. And then are you familiar with many upselling techniques or assumptions? You know, for example, executive coaching might lead to team coaching, might lead to team workshop, might lead to something else. Have you thought through these things or seen many examples of it?
Yeah, I've thought through these things. I've seen some examples of it. So it would be, of course, like the freemium model where there's free knowledge tools. So like Julian Cole is a great example of this. One of the ways that I think he does a great job of productizing his skill set and his self is by sharing tons of free resources. So free brief templates and decks and doing great use cases of particular strategy approaches and sharing them freely with the strategy community. What is smart about that is that it shows and gives people a taste of here's what it would be like to work with me. Mm-hmm. It shows his thinking and it helps demonstrate the value of doing a paid engagement with him. And so that is a product that he's not charging for, but it's also a very strong lead opportunity. So not quite an upsell in the way that you're talking about, but a way that I think starts to convert higher paying business through something that's lower barrier to entry.
Yep. How do you navigate the idea of giving stuff away for free? Like some of us just get into that lifestyle and there's definitely a nagging thing in the back of our minds. Like, oh, is this, are we like being entrepreneur? Are we smart doing this? And then some of us just, that's how we live and we just have to do it for some reason. It's probably because of childhood neglect, yeah. I'm just saying. But like, I'm joking. But like,
it's fine. I'm in therapy too. It's great.
I'm totally not joking. I'm joking. How do you, because there are four of you having these kinds of conversations, how do you debate what's free, what to not make free? How do you test and learn that kind of stuff?
It kind of comes back to the idea of accessible and our core values. So everyone is going to have different values that may be lifestyle, that may be things that they value about their work life. If you are the type of person that is valuing a certain lifestyle or work life, it may make sense for you to charge money for strategy products and be less engaged in the day-to-day consulting or service-based side of our business because you can charge a lower amount of money for things, sell a higher volume of them, and not have to be as engaged one-on-one, which is very time-consuming because then your time becomes the most valuable thing. For us, we happen to very highly value change in our industry. Our business is called Current Forward. It is about how do you move things forward for clients? How do we move things forward as an industry? And so when we put out our Bias in the Brief workbook, for example, we did it at a pay what you want model because we believe that things like combating unconscious bias in the strategy process should be knowledge that everyone has access to. There is a big issue, I believe, in the strategy community with gatekeeping traditionally. I think that's starting to change because of people like you and me and Julian and Kim McKenzie, who started the Ladies Who Strategize group. There are a lot of people putting in a lot of different efforts to connect strategists, to debunk and demystify our work as something that is exclusive. And for us, we think about, is the knowledge in this something that people should have access to? And if so, it is free. And or it is pay what you want as a donation to our future efforts in being able to hold other events that are free and being able to continue to devote time to putting out content that educates people and helps them do strategy work themselves or grow their careers. Mm-hmm. And then the ones that we charge for, so products that we charge for, are things that are kind of a middle ground between that thing that we think people should have access to and what a deeper engagement with our business would be like. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Like, so it sounds like it's helpful to have the bookends, you know? So for me,
yeah,
for example,
yeah, that's a great way of thinking about it.
If it's spontaneous, if I'm playing with ideas, they're usually going to be free and they're going to be on the internet and I'm going to learn from people interacting with them. And then on the other hand, the other bookend of that is like, here's the deep, more involved interaction that I want, and I want to establish good value for that, and it's going to look like this. And then there are things in the middle. So for me, I think of things like, so I've got spontaneous random thoughts, potentially free. If I'm in a room where I don't bring a presentation and I'm using the people's brains in the room to make the experience happen, the training, mm-hmm. like a Socratic kind of thing, then that's, I might not charge the same as I would if it was like multiple days of training, which
yeah.
is different to multiple days of research and strategy. So there's kind of these little frameworks and models that appear in their head. Do you have shorthand language for the labels that you would use for these frameworks? Oh my gosh, my questions are a bit vague because it's such a nebulous thing to even talk about. You know, I've seen different, you know, people break down.
Welcome to strategy world, yeah, everybody. I don't, let's see if I can come up with one on the spot. I would maybe say content and ideas. I think content and ideas are free. I try to be a good friend, a good collaborator, a good partner, and a good member of our community by sharing ideas and content for free. I do that because I have a faith, and I think you probably do too, without, you know, trying to project onto you too much, but I have a faith that I have more ideas. I think that ideas are plentiful. I know I will always have more ideas. And so therefore, to me, there is no risk of sharing ideas if it means that things get to take life and they get to change the way we do things in our industry. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the free end of the spectrum. Ideas and content are free. Products, for me, are in the middle, because a product is kind of like, I could go to CVS and buy a product. I could go to Amazon and buy a product. Something about it feels, I hate this word, but like a cheapening of our discipline, which is not my intention at all, but what we're trying to say is like, it's a way of making our discipline more accessible and more packaged. So like that products would probably be in the middle there. And then on the higher end of the spectrum in terms of level of effort, level of energy expenditure, level of engagement, level of money would be services, which to me at least imply bespoke. That is something that's going to be custom. There might be a list that says a competitive audit, but that competitive audit is going to be different no matter who we're doing that for. So it is always something that is going to be a higher barrier to entry engagement.
Okay. How do you have pricing discussions about all these things with your team? Is it a matter of pick a number? Is it a matter of pick a number? And not that we're going to sell time for all these things, but let's also think about how much we would sell and how, like, for time and how much time it would take. How do you navigate that?
So for products, it's pick a number. We look at some of what other products out there that we think are similar are priced for, and the value that we think it brings. So for example, if you know your own hourly rate, or you have an internal hourly rate in mind that you're trying to stay around, even if you do project-based fee work, typically the fee work on the, I guess, on the service side of things is estimated by level of effort times rough hourly fee. And that's how you arrive at about what that might be. Usually you add in a little buffer in case it goes over time and hope that it actually comes under time. There's a fee model. On the product side, if you think about what an hour on the phone, if you could just pay for an hour of my time, what that would cost, we try to price products well below that. So prior to forming Current Forward, I put out a workbook called the DIY Strategy Workbook, which has like three different exercises in it to help you narrow down your ideas and kind of put together a plan on how to bring one of those ideas to life. And I priced the DIY Strategy Workbook at $29, significantly less than an hour of my time on the phone with me. But some of the things that I found, I was telling almost anyone and everyone who wanted to pick my brain about things to do. And so for me, looking at other workbooks, for example, that were out there, what their price is for, and the value that I knew that that would bring to them, it will take about an afternoon. It's not going to take you probably a quick hour. It'll take a little while. I felt like $29 felt right. So there was no magic formula.
Yep. Yeah, I think there's honesty in that. I've worked with people who are career salespeople selling intellectual services and products. And when they're candid with me, they're like, you just start to think about what you want to charge and then increase it a lot. And they're not going to say, like, see what you can get away with. I hear salespeople talking about that. But that is part of what's going on. It's not how I think. But I think it's actually very interesting to surround yourself with some people who do think like that, because strategy people can be a little bit too self-deprecating sometimes. I mean, I know that a lot of us who've done this for a while, who've interviewed a lot of people, you could be in a 30-minute conversation and hear something from a client or a potential client, and you go, holy crap, that is that phrase, those three words, we could play with that. And then it's like, well, how much does that cost? Because that took just 30 minutes. And I was, you know, so I think we can be a bit self-deprecating with these things. And it's nice being with more extravagant salespeople.
What I would say about that, do you mind if I respond to that real quick?
Yeah, totally.
So the thing I would say about that, though, too, is this is a very common way that, you know, unlike productizing, I actually think that way of thinking is one of the biggest culprits of devaluing the work of strategy. Is if you think, oh, well, I just came up with it in 30 minutes, you know, it isn't that valuable, you are is absolutely wrong. You came up with it in 30 minutes because of the 10 years of experience you had before that that allowed you to get to an answer faster. And so because of that, I do think people need to be very thoughtful about things like their hourly rates. Just because you can do things in a short amount of time does not mean that it is easy or cheap. It actually is quite expensive to get to the point where you can do things in a shorter amount of time. So we do have to take a little bit more credit for our ability to synthesize information quickly when we've achieved that level in our career.
Yeah, I agree. Caitlin, give yourself a shout out. Where can people find these products that you've made?
Good question. So currentforward.com, it's currentfwd.com, is where if you go to products, you can find our Bias in the Brief workbook. It's actually on Gumroad. We love them. If any of you all are interested in putting products out there in the world, they make it easy and cheap to do so. So the Bias in the Brief workbook is up there as a pay what you want. I have my DIY strategy workbook on Gumroad as well. We have something that we just put out that I think kind of sparked this conversation, which is the strategy hotline. So it's a consulting package. We rigged up an actual landline telephone where folks can pay for credits to talk to members of our team on life advice, strategy advice, scoping research. It's a lot easier than hiring a freelancer. We run into some trouble sometimes with people getting recs approved on the agency side in particular. Mm-hmm. So if you can just buy time in that way, it tends to get approved a little bit easier. And we're sort of on demand to people, which was something that came up a lot as how people wanted to work with us. That's on our website. It's just currentfwd.com/hotline. So, and then follow us on social. We're at currentfwd everywhere, and we're constantly testing and learning different products to see what ways people want to engage with us. And if you have any ideas of ways that we can make ourselves more accessible to you, please let us know. This is just a big part of our process now, and we're keen to continue working with the community in this way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm excited about, I think, what's coming, this underground and then not, or hopefully then not underground, explosion of strategy literature and entrepreneurship.
Gosh, I hope so.
Entrepreneurship. And a lot of us have to fight our egos, which is to say, oh, I had that thought and I didn't launch it, or I had that thought, I launched it, or, you know, I'm not going to support other people who are trying to create this independent life because, you know, we're competing. And I'm like, I think we're under so much pressure really out there that if we can actually support each other, we need to grow the category of what we're doing. And but I just want to acknowledge that, because we see it all the time. Someone posts something and maybe I did it to you, which is like, you know, here's a thing I made. And someone's like, oh, I did that 10 years ago. And you're like, cool, that's great. Good for you. Are we supporting each other here? Are we competing? And if we're competing, we're competing over something that's shrinking. So that's not smart. So
yeah, not at all. And I believe every single day when you wake up, ideas are plentiful. I will have more.
Yes.
I will have more ideas. Believe in your own ability to have great ideas. You would not be in this field of work if you did not. And that's for you, but for everyone who's listening, like, we are in the idea business. Believe that one person having a similar idea, it does not diminish your ability to have great ideas.
Totally. Ideas are infinite, and everything that exists is a creative constraint. So you just get to use what exists to get somewhere new. Caitlin, thank you for sharing with me your thoughts on creating products. I hope everything is going beautifully and warmly in Austin, and hopefully I'll get to see you and your crew sometime soon.
Oh, thanks so much, Mark. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you. Peace.